Chapter 9. The Neophyte. Star Cunning. The Scarlet Orrery. The weeping wasn't the worst thing about Committee Sona. As he drifted in and out of chemical and psychic fugues, the dull sounds of sorrow no longer touched him. The sterile gloom was filled with endless sobbing, grunts, sometimes in pain, sometimes in what passed here for pleasure. Plaintive wails, pleas for help, and the rhythmic drumming of fists or skulls against the impervious metal of a cell wall. After a while, the only sorrow anyone cared for in Committee Sona was their own. How long had he been here? He didn't know. Time was impossible to judge, but years must have passed since the fright-masked warriors with yellow eyes had thrown him to the Silent Sisters. It wasn't even the violence. The brutality of many inmates could not be subdued by chemicals or the threat of cortical overload collars. Beatings were a daily occurrence, and deaths frequent. He kept clear of trouble when it reared its fists or bared a crude blade. The worst of it had passed him by, but not all trouble was avoidable. The gouged socket where his left eye had once sat was proof of that. Nor was it their jailers, the half-human, half-cybernetic servitors that patrolled the metalled corridors and tomb-like cells were predictable, and the bronze-armored sisters used force only when necessary. When they did, it was swift and shocking and utterly without mercy, but there was always purpose to it. Nor was it the nightmares. When silence fell in Committee Sona, it fell completely. When the sorrow finally ended, when the violence abated and their captors withdrew, the soundless void that was left was rich with nightmares. Nightmares of skull-masked interrogators with iron-braided beards and yellowed eyes, of agonizing trawls through his mind that left him screaming and soiled, endlessly repeated questions drilled into his skull like hot skewers, questions to which he had no answer. One accusation laid against him again and again. Maleficarum. Over and over in unending hammer blows. Maleficarum. 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 It broke him. These men and their questions and insults and agonies, they stripped him of every last shred of dignity and made him less than human. But eventually it stopped. Eventually they were satisfied he had told them all he knew, that every last secret had been ripped out of him. And when it stopped, he thanked them. He loved them for making the pain go away. But not even the nightmares of pain and the wolf-cloaked interrogators were the worst part of Committee Sona. The worst of it was the undiluted hate that now filled him. Hate for the one who had put him here. Arzek Ahriman. Bodvar Biaki was lean compared to his brothers of the Vulka Fenrika, and the warrior in the unmarked plate walking alongside him was half a head taller. Hawk-nosed and clear-eyed, he had the look of eagles upon him.
"You're one of Jarl Gilliman's, aren't you?" he said.
"I was," said the warrior, as Sister Caesaria and her hulking battle robots led them through an adamantium gate. Beyond the gate was a long ribbed chamber with dark walls glistening wetly like something fresh risen from the ocean depths. Biaki nodded towards the mortal warrior in lacquered armour with the finely balanced sword. Followed by thrall warriors of flesh and iron, he walked with Sister Caesaria, answering her questions with short, vague answers.
Yasu Nagasena tells me you are called Dio Promus.
That is correct.
You look like one of the stone men the uplanders built on Fenris, said Biaki. They look pretty for maybe a season, but they fall down as soon as the land's roots get soft.
And you look like the statue of Bardilis carved over the Civitas Gate on Macrag.
Who is Bardilis? A Jarl of the 500 Worlds?
No, a barbarian defeated by Lord Gilliman in his youth.
Biaki grinned, exposing his fangs.
If he killed this Bardilis, why raise a statue to him?
He did not kill him, said Promus. He spared his life, and in return Bardilis swore an oath of loyalty to Lord Gilliman at the gathering of Paeonia, which proves even a savage can recognize greatness. Biaki turned to his warriors with a mock grimace.
I think I have just been insulted. You should kill him, said Svavnir Rackwolf in guttural Vergen.
Biaki nodded, as though considering Rackwolf's advice.
What did he just say? Asked Promus.
He asks if you are star cunning, like me.
Biaki watched Promus's gaze roam over his armor, noting the runic cuts encircling his heart cage, the toothed amulet set upon his breast, and the lupine talismans hung from iron cords looped around his arms.
I am a psyker, yes, agreed Promus, like you.
What is it your lot calls it? A rune priest?
I think maybe we are both very powerful,
nodded Biaki, spitting on the dark metal of the floor.
But here, that counts for nothing. This place is not kind to brothers of the weird.
The weird? Biaki spun on his heel to face his brothers, walking backwards with a disbelieving shake of his head.
Fenris Hjulda! Dio Promus knows not of the weird.
He is Uplander and comes with Iron Men instead of Clan Brothers,
said Har Balagir, his one good eye hooded and hostile.
Why would he?
You serve this sigilite, yes,
said Biaki, turning back to Promus as they passed into a tall chamber with glyph-cut walls that tapered inwards to a point far above.
Like Yasu Nagasena.
I serve the Emperor, said Promus,
and in his mind's eye he saw the face of Veristus Cirillo and countless others.
But not like Nagasena.
You kill the Allfather's enemies?
Yes.
Then you serve him like us.
Why are you here, Bodvar Biaki? Asked Promus, as squads of the Silent Sisterhood appeared from hexagonal tunnels on either side to march with them. The Vorax and Ursarax cohorts tensed, but Promus shook his head.
Why do you think we are here?
To stand at my side and slay me if I turn traitor.
Maybe. Maybe not,
said Biaki, tapping a blackened shred of oath paper fixed to his armor with wax imprinted with the sigilite seal.
We do not relish such tasks. The Wolf King commands it, so we obey.
I'm flattered, said Promus. But I thought your sire only sent watchpacks to the halls of his brother Primarchs.
Biaki gave a weary shrug.
We are not a true watchpack. We do not have that honor. But we still watch, yes, because you and I both know that of those who turn, star cunning make the worst enemies.
He looked Promus in the eye.
Prospero taught us that.
Promus halted his march and met Biaki's gaze. The Vorax, bringing up the rear, hissed by Narek irritation at the delay.
You were there, he asked.
You fought the Thousand Sons. Biaki nodded.
We lost many brothers in the fight, but we killed the Demon Lord's sons.
Demon Lord?
Yeah, Magnus, the King in Crimson,
said Biaki, covering one eye with his hand.
Svavnir Rackwolf back there slew more of his red sorcerers than any could count with that bloody great null spear of his. And Olgiar Widdowson, he alone of his pack survived the last battle before the Great Pyramid of Glass.
Biaki pointed to a barrel-chested legionary with a forked beard and a clicking mechanized red eye.
Har Balagir tore his own eye out when facing a sorcerer lord, rather than suffer the Maleficarum he sent to kill him. Aye, and the Skjalds never let me forget it,
bellowed Balagir, causing the sisters to turn in alarm. He wrapped the knuckle of his thumb against the eye.
Like I need reminding. And that,
said Biaki, nodding towards a warrior whose legs and one arm were the bare metal of augmetics,
is Gyr Lothnir Hellblind, shield-bearer of Thra, he who stood over Widdowson as fiends of the Underverse tried to cut his thread.
He's more bionic than flesh. Bjarki leaned in as if sharing a joke.
It's why we call him Spear Inviter. He welcomes pain a little too much, I think.
Don't we all? Asked Promus.
Lemuel?
He looked up, blinking in the gloom. Shapes. A faint outline of two women silhouetted in the door of his cell. His hands instinctively tightened on the ceramic urn he cradled. He'd kept it safe all these years, and everyone in Committee Sona knew never to touch it. For reasons Lemuel was never able to fathom, even the Silent Sisters turned a blind eye to it. The woman who'd spoken took a step into his cell. Her skin had once been beautifully tanned, but like every soul within Committee Sona, it was now light-starved and ghoulishly pallid. Her hair, once long and dark, was now grey and cropped. Only her eyes still held to their vitality, one emerald green, the other hazel flecked with gold. Her companion was fine-boned and dark-skinned, but she too was blanched and hollowed out by confinement.
Camille, said Lemuel. Jaya?
Yes, said Camille. Are you ready?
Ready.
We are going to walk together, you remember?
We were,
he said, his voice little more than a parched wheeze.
Yes, a walk together.
Like everything within Lemuel's mind, his recollection of Camille and Chaya was fractured and unreliable. He thought they had been friends once, somewhere that felt far away and long ago. They remembered that too, so it was probably true. His life before Committee Sona was a book with pages that turned too fast, and with some of the words missing. His most cherished memories were gone, torn from his mind or left so fragmentary as to be meaningless. But despite all the skull-masked interrogators had done to them, all that had been broken inside their heads, they could still remember that friendship.
Yes,
he said again.
We'd like that.
Lemuel smiled and pushed himself from the mattress laid against the wall of his cell. Together with a rubberized bowl half filled with piss, it was the only furniture permitted. He took a moment to steady himself. He remembered being a big man once, but his frame was spare and wasted after years of prison food.
Where will we walk today?
He asked.
Perhaps a stroll through the Elysian fields, suggested Camille. Before ending up at the Asphodel Meadows?
You always imagine the best places,
said Lemuel, as they stood aside to let him pass. Camille smiled and nodded to the urn he carried.
Hello, Callista, she said.
They left the upper levels with its rows of cells and descended to the main floor. This part of Committee Sona was a vast arched space, hundreds of meters in width and many hundreds in height. The ceiling was a curving vault, its black walls of smooth stone gridded with alcove cells like reliquary chambers in a vast catacomb. What light there was came from the walls themselves, unchanging and eternal, a lifeless illumination that leached all it touched of vitality. Over 1,000 people were housed in the chamber. Like Lemuel, Camille, and Chaya, they wore dirty smocks and chafing collars of dark metal that felt heavier than they looked and kept their wearers in a torpid state of mind. Some inmates gathered in small groups, while others wandered listlessly from place to place in their own private miseries. Most remained in their cells, too broken and too exhausted to rise from their soiled mattresses. Camille knelt to talk to a sour-faced mother with a small boy of around 6 years. Births were strictly forbidden in Committee Sona, so the child must have arrived with her.
I think I remember him as a babe in arms, said Lemuel.
Has it really been so long?
Said Chaya.
What's his name?
Asked Lemuel.
I can't recall.
I don't know,
she said, and her eyes filled with tears. Lemuel had fleeting memories of knowing Chaya in better times. He remembered her strength and poise. To see her so lost was like looking in a mirror.
It's Ferris,
said Camille, rising and taking Chaya's hand.
Ferris, remember? His mother is Medea, and her son is Ferris.
Ferris. Yes, that was it. Frail and thin-boned and given to extended bouts of overblown weeping and petulance. Not an easy child to like. But what kind of a childhood could he have in so awful a place?
Yes,
said Chaya. And Lemuel could see her struggle to embed the name in her memory.
Yes, Ferris. Come on, let's keep walking,
said Camille, leading them away from Ferris and his sullen mother.
We're walking through the golden fields of Elysium, a land where there is no want, no hunger, and only bliss.
Lemuel smiled, trying to picture the blessed lands. Only Camille could conjure such vivid imagery with her words.
Had that been her calling before coming here?
Was she a teller of tales, a playwright or poet?
The sun is golden on our skin, continued Camille, as they moved across the floor. It's warm, and the sky is blue, the colour of the open ocean. The wind stirs the crops, and the aroma of cut stalks and harvested grain fills the air.
Coppered servo skulls flew overhead, shock calipers buzzing with lethal energy. But Lemuel ignored them, allowing his mind to escape somewhere beautiful.
Where are we going?
He asked.
There's a villa ahead, said Camille.
The words freighted with her own longing.
Fig trees grow in the courtyard, their branches heavy with fruit, and children are playing in their shade. There's a table set with food fresh from the fields, and there's sweet wine in earthenware jugs ready to be poured. All our friends are waiting for us.
Camille and Shire held hands as they walked. They had been lovers before coming here, and nothing they had endured since had broken that bond. Lemuel held to a fragment of memory, a woman with sad eyes waving goodbye to him from a roof veranda. But who she was remained out of reach.
Malika?
Was that her name?
Who was she to him?
He couldn't remember, and that loss tormented him. But he still had Callista. She was dead, he knew that, of course. Her ashes filled the urn he carried. Lemuel could not remember the details of how she died, only the name and face of her killer. Arzek Ahriman. A name without meaning or attachment, a focus for the terrifying hatred he carried inside. A hatred that sustained Lemuel in the times between Camille's pleasant fictions, when he could not keep the nightmares of wolf-cloaked warriors and pain at bay.
Get away!
Cried a screeching voice, dragging him from his reverie of blue skies and sunshine, sweet wine and fresh food. Lemuel flinched as a near-naked man with a shaven scalp leapt out in front of him.
Back off, Prin, said Camille. We're just walking.
No! You can't stand there! This is Prin's way out!
He yelled, his eyes darting between them and the floating servo skulls.
You can't be here! They'll see! They'll see!
Prin's entire body was covered with infected weals and scabs where he'd scratched himself raw. He lunged forwards, and Lemuel tripped, almost losing his grip on Callista's urn.
Get away!
Screamed Prin, spittle flying from his mouth as he stood over Lemuel, clawing the air with bloodied fingernails.
This is where they're coming for me! They're coming to take me with them this time!
I said back off, Prin, repeated Camille, pushing the madman away and cocking a fist at her shoulder. Prin continued to claw the air with increasing desperation. He sank to his knees and ripped his fingernails down his cheeks hard enough to draw blood. He shook his head and burst into tears.
I'm not worthy yet, and they don't forgive that,
sobbed Prin.
Do you know what happens to those who aren't worthy?
No, and I don't care, snapped Camille, pushing past the lunatic.
They promised,
wailed Prin.
I tried and tried. I said the words they whispered, but they never answered. They promised this was where they'd come for me.
Chaya offered her hand to Lemuel, but he ignored it, clutching Callista's urn to his chest as he climbed to his feet. They left Prin weeping and tearing his skin, all thoughts of escape to fantasies of the Elysium fields forgotten.
Crazy bastard,
said Camille. Caesarea and her castellans led them deeper into Comitissona, through a succession of geometric chambers, somewhere between abandoned feigned crypts and fabricatus temples. The sense of a place monstrously repurposed was evident in the uneasy symbiosis of ancient architecture and human technology. At length, the journey ended before an enormous gate of polished metal, carved with more of the disturbingly alien glyphs. Heavy chains of dark iron ran from two enormous metal berthing rings to darkened alcoves on either side. Within each alcove, the shadowed suggestion of a vast statue cast in dulled bronze was barely visible. Weapon turrets clattered as autoloaders fed belts of shells into breaches. Promus licked his lips as he felt his mouth dry a little at the sight of the wide-muzzled autocannons. He had no doubt they were intended to gun down rogue psykers, but what practices were in place to prevent them engaging psykers who were not prisoners? As if reading his mind, Biaki chuckled and said,
"Now we will see if this place can tell the difference between star cunning and maleficarum."
The targeting mechanisms blinked from red to green, and Promus let out a relieved breath. Biaki grinned and slapped a hand on his shoulder guard.
"You are worried for a moment," he said.
"I do not entirely trust weapons without a soul."
"Yet you surround yourself with such things."
"It suits my purpose for the moment."
"And what purpose is that?"
"My own." Biaki turned to address his warriors.
"We must keep a close eye on this one," he said with a toothed grin. "He keeps secrets like the Goti." "And tell him to keep them to himself,"
offered Svavnir Rackwolf.
"No good can come of learning them."
The other wolves grunted in agreement, and Promus relaxed his grip on the hilt of the gladius at his hip. Sister Caesarea marched to the gate and placed both hands upon it as if to push it wide open.
"That's the big gate, and you are only small,"
Biaki called out to her.
"Do you want some help?"
She ignored him and stood unmoving for several seconds, until a bass rumble sounded from the alcoves to either side of the gate. A deafening bray of horns, like a huntsman's call, shook the dust from the upper reaches of the chamber.
"Fenris the Older!"
cried Gyr Lothnir Hellblind, bringing his shield to bear as the statues stepped forwards with booming strides. The wolves ran to their rune priest, though they could surely do nothing against such giants.
"God, ancients," said Biaki in amazement.
The Arethusa's automata and iron thrall warriors shrank from these apex beasts, cowed by their majesty.
"Warhounds," said Promus.
The two titans growled in hostile binaric, venting plumes of hot petrochemical exhaust. Their enormous weapons were kill-ready, and scented oils drizzled from the bronzed plates of their armor like baptismal rain. They turned to the gate and bent their shoulders, legs bracing and colossal servo motors straining as they matched their strength against its weight. At first it seemed as though its mass would defeat them. Then, with the groan of grinding stone, a thin seam of light appeared at the center of the gate. Concussive shocks traveled the walls as the warhounds pushed the gate wider, millimeter by millimeter.
"Something's amiss," said Olgir Widowson,
tearing off his helm and dropping to one knee. "What is he doing?" said Promus, as the wolf closed his one good eye and placed an ear to the ground, palms flat to either side of his shaven, tattooed skull. Biaki held up his hand.
"Olgir Widowson knows better than any dowser when land roots grow soft."
"Land roots?"
"Yeah. When Fenris chooses to drag land down into the world forge beneath the oceans."
Promus had only a vague idea what that meant, but sensed trouble as Yasu Nagasena ran back towards them, one hand pressed to his ear, the other clutching the hilt of his sword. Olgir Widowson pushed himself to his feet.
"What say you?"
said Biaki.
"This place was struck," said the wolf, "from without."
"Struck," said Promus, as his helmvox crackled with the distorted simulacra voice of Majos Umvelt Uexkul.
"Promus! Another vessel is inbound!"
"Say again, Uxkul," ordered Promus.
"I repeat, say again."
The static fell away, and this time there was no mistaking the master of the Arethusa's warning.
Promus, another vessel is inbound.
Nagasena read the change in Promus's body language.
You're hurt?
He asked. Promus nodded. Another vessel.
It's them, said Bjarki. It's the Red Sorceress.
Hit it again,
ordered Ignis, sending a precision firing solution to the empowered lance battery in the Kemet's prow. The Oculus Bay flashed with actinic light, and an explosion bloomed on the orbital jail's flank, exactly where Ignis expected. A geyser of blue flame ejected from the breach, quickly snuffed out by hard vacuum. A mist of debris, hundreds of kilometers in diameter, mushroomed from the impact site. A pair of branching towers, like leafless trees in winter, spiraled into the void. Ignis sat in the Kemet's command throne, eyes locked on the Oculus Bay and drinking in bewilderingly swift data flows, ordnance trajectories, attack intercepts, thrust vectors and angles of deflection. Woven so densely as to be unintelligible to anyone other than an adept versed in the Calculi Arcana of the Order of Ruin, but supremely beautiful to Ignis. A perfect synergy of mathematical convergences and statistical certainties. Void War, fought under the aegis of ruin, was, to Ignis, simply a matter of manipulating numerologically significant equations of breathtaking elegance. He passed endless streams of numbers without error, distributing aspect corrections, course changes, and firing solutions to the crew with breathtaking speed and clarity.
Port side maneuvering arrays, 36% thrust for 2.7 seconds. Reciprocal compensation to starboard on cessation. On my mark. Mark.
The Kemet responded to his command like a trained colt, sliding through the darkness with the verve and aggression of a much smaller vessel. The flagstones vibrated to volleys of macro cannon fire from the broadside batteries far below. Mere distraction fire, explosive bluster, to keep the two vessels at high anchor on the ventral aspect of Committee Sona wary.
Forward lance array primed and charged,
sent Tolbeck from the prow gun deck. The Pyrai adepts were down there, bleeding the heat build-up that normally restricted such a powerful weapon's rate of discharge and empowering its beam with the fire of the great ocean.
Weapon release only on my mark, he sent. Solution Ignis 396, if you please.
We can hit them now,
sent Tolbeck, and Ignis winced at the blunt forcefulness of his brother's urge to shoot.
On my mark only.
We're sliding out of angle of deflection.
On my mark only.
Ignis, in the name of Mark.
A searing cerulean beam of light stabbed from the Kemet's prow and carved the topside of Committee Sona like a butcher removing a layer of fat from a carcass. Silent explosions marched across the exposed underbelly of flensed hull plates as they peeled back. The great ocean flooded within as etheric discharge exploded into space like Mechanicum Borealis over a rad-soaked forge world. Ignis smiled, his fingers steepled before him.
Lord Ahriman,
he sent to the embarkation deck.
Is it done?
As promised, said Ignis. You have your way in.
Warning klaxons blared. Emergency lights strobed as fresh impacts rocked the prison. A powerful charge filled Committee Sona, as if some vital element of atmospheric composition had been forcefully restored. Its inmates stood blinking and amazed, drawing in great lungfuls of potency, staring at the world through newly unveiled eyes. Lemuel felt a growing clarity as the environment changed, becoming more tactile and real with every breath. The collar around his neck was smoking as though plucked from a furnace, but its touch was icy, and pale patterns of frost webbed its surfaces.
"What happened?"
he said, as the chamber fell into anarchy.
"Nothing good," said Camille,
dragging him and Chaya to the relative safety of projecting stone steps.
"We need to keep out of the way."
No sooner had she spoken than a pack of servo skulls, fitted with underslung las carbines and shock calipers, zipped through the air towards them.
"Get down!"
she yelled. Lemuel threw himself flat next to Chaya. A blizzard of lasfire burned the air. He looked over his shoulder. A group of inmates were screaming. Lasburn set their smocks ablaze, and they flailed like madmen until pain overcame them. One man remained standing, oblivious to the killing flames consuming him. He laughed and hurled the fire back at the skulls in a blazing stream that shattered them into bony splinters. A dozen more fixed on the burning man, and he vanished in a form of lignite and electro-flame until his screaming laughter was abruptly ended. Hard bangs Lemuel recognized as bolter fire added to the deafening cacophony. Forking blasts of what looked like horizontal lightning flashed from somewhere above them. Inchoate laughter echoed in his skull. He tasted blood and sour bile, the sensation of biting on metal. The collar was painfully cold around his neck. Frost flaked from it like cinders and drifted in curious spirals.
"Stay together," said Chaya,
pressed tight to the steps and her eyes tight shut as she held Camille.
"Together, yes. That's Prospero's way."
Prospero. Lemuel gasped as the name lodged in his mind like a knife in the ribs. His body shuddered as he saw a dreaming city of white marble, tree-lined boulevards, and the scent of far-off lands carried over the open ocean. Tears welled in his eyes for no reason he could articulate.
"Tisca,"
he said, remembering the sight of the city from the air as he left, believing he would never see it again, yet knowing, with improbable certainty, that he would.
"What was that?"
asked Chaya, her dark eyes swimming with memory.
"Say it again."
"Tisca,"
said Lemuel.
"We were there, weren't we?"
"Yes, Lemuel.
Yes, you're right, we were,"
said Chaya, tears streaming down her gaunt cheeks.
It is my home. I live there."
"No, throne, no,"
said Lemuel, as snatches of things overheard while he bled and sweated in earthen pits that reeked of wild animals returned to him.
"Tisca's gone. The wolves, they burned it. To get to Magnus."
All three of them flinched as the name left his lips, its syllables a key that unlocked a yammering host of competing memories. None of them could speak, too overwhelmed by the flood of painful thoughts of things lost and things endured. Acrid vapors stung Lemuel's eyes, and the smell of roasting meat made his mouth hatefully moist. Lasfire and streams of promethium scorched the air, and fatty smoke billowed from living pyres. Despite the flames, the air felt blisteringly cold in Lemuel's lungs. Newly empowered, the inmates of Committee Sona gave free rein to their abilities. Nightmares clawed the air, and hurricane winds twisted smoke into chattering spectres with sharp teeth and pitiless eyes. Mortal bodies swelled with power, becoming monstrous and insane. Flesh warped and minds cracked as immaterial vampires claimed eager victims and remade possessed flesh in their own image. Hurricanes of psychic energy roared like dark laughter, and muttering shadows dragged men and women into the walls and floor. Warriors, armored in bronze and with plumes of red and white, marched undaunted into the madness. They were moments of stillness within the storms of unleashed witchery, but they were few. Hunting in ad hoc squads, the warriors, shoulder-locked weapons, executed with every trigger pull.
"They're killing everyone,"
wept Chaya. Hundreds of prisoners crawled through pools of blood to find safety or hunkered down behind shredded barricades of the dead. Lemuel saw Medea and her son wrapped in each other's arms, a squad of the Silent Sisters armed with flamers advancing towards them.
"We have to help them," said Camille.
"Don't be an idiot, Camille,"
cried Lemuel, grabbing her wrist and pulling her back.
"Do you want to get killed?"
She fought him, but fear for her life gave Lemuel strength.
"You can't let them die."
"Better them than you,"
said Lemuel, horrified and ashamed that he meant every word. The depth of disappointment in Camille's eyes cut to the heart of him. She released the fabric of his smock in her fist and recoiled, clutching her hand as though burned. She cried out, eyes wide in horror and misted with visions only she could see.
"Are you hurt?"
screamed Chaya.
"Did they hit you?"
Camille shook her head, staring at Lemuel as if seeing him for the first time and being repulsed by what was revealed.
"What is it?"
he said.
"He slit the throats of innocents and drank their blood,"
said Camille.
"He murdered seers to steal what they saw."
"What? No!"
cried Lemuel. "I didn't!"
Not you, wept Camille. The last man.
What last man?
Who wore that smock before you,
she said.
Well, how can you know that?
He asked. But as soon as he asked the question, he knew. The frosted collar around his neck shattered into blackened fragments of ice, and the fog deadening his thoughts these last 5 years blew out in the face of inrushing psychic energy. He knew exactly how Camille could know that. Psychometry. The power to know the history of an object through touch alone. Just as he knew that Chaya was a low-level telepath, and that they had first met on Prospero, when he'd come to tell Camille a psychic predator had laid its eggs in her skull. Just as he knew he was a reader of auras, a diviner of truths, who had been taught to harness that power by... A roar of ear-bursting warhorns buckled the air, and Lemuel felt the abrasive presence of vast, bellicose auras wedded to predatory machine souls. They were pushing the towering gates at the far end of the chamber open, and they would kill everything before them in a storm of fire and fury.
"Got to get off the main floor," said Lemuel, as the gate opened yet farther. "Got to get back to our cells."
Camille nodded, gasping for breath and keeping her fingers laced together for fear of touching anything else. The horrors of this place were myriad, and she had no wish for even the least of them to touch her.
"Come on,"
said Lemuel, easing around the bottom of the stone steps. Fused bodies, melded, bent, and elongated by means mortal anatomy was never meant to employ, lay twisted at their base. He crawled over undulant flesh that bubbled with suckered mouths and blinking eyes. He wept as he climbed, keeping Callista's ashes held in the crook of his arm. They climbed from the madness and the screams, away from the gunshots, the storms of lightning, and cackling monsters guised in human meat. Lemuel reached an upper landing, when a dreadful sense of premonition made him look back into the chaos below. Standing at the epicenter of the bloodshed, and surrounded by a ring of howling warp lunatics, was Prynne, miraculously untouched, save by his own hand. Wild-eyed, he clawed his skin with bloodied fingernails, the king of the madmen.
"They're here!"
he screamed with wild exultation.
"Please take me! I've done all you asked! I'm one of you now!"
And finally Prynne's pleas were answered. With each lacerated strip of skin he tore away, sick light poured out, his inner workings radiant and blood divine. The change working upon him intensified, skin, arteries and muscle unravelling like fraying thread. Organs burst and blood aerosolized around the man, coagulating and orbiting his flesh in a grotesque scarlet orrery. Prynne's form was lost in the maelstrom of his unmaking, yet his screams went undiminished. The red mist of his remains hung in a veil. Hulking shapes moved within. Lemuel's bowels clenched as a warrior stepped through what Prynne's death had wrought. An angel of death, plated in gleaming crimson and blooded ivory. A legionary, and behind him many more. They spread out, wet with Prynne's transformation. Every one of them was radiant, haloed by a blazing aura of infinite complexity. The warrior leading them burned brightest of all.
"Azek,"